From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis with a show that connects you to the people, the places, and yeah, the protests of Southern California. It was mayhem on Thursday in the city of Orange. That's no hyperbole. You hear it. The school board there became the latest here in California to require schools to notify parents if their kids are out as transgender at school. There was bullhorn projected prayer in multiple languages before that vote.
Ven Jesús poderoso, ven San Miguel Arcángel, cúbrenos con tu poder y la espada.
And there was a raucous celebration after the vote.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion passes.
I'm feeling outstanding. We have chills right now. We also helped the parents in Chino, Temecula, Marietta, and we are not anti-LGB. We are united.
A half dozen school districts in this blue state have passed similar policies in recent months. Culture war clashes are firing up at school boards all across the United States. So what's going on? KCRW's Robin Estrin was at that board meeting in Orange when the policy passed. And Robin is with us right now. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Steve.
Well, all right. So we got a sense of what the meeting was like. We certainly heard the prayer and we heard the jubilation after the vote and things like that and the bullhorn. Talk a little bit about what you saw.
There was intense conflict at this meeting from beginning to end. People were lined up hours before the meeting, waiting for public comment cards. And there was clashing throughout the evening. There was a big, loud group of right-wing and conservative activists who'd come to the meeting from outside the district. I asked Wen Hong, director of Viet Rainbow Orange County, which is an LGBTQ group out there, to read some of their signs for me.
Pedophiles keep secrets, tell parents the truth. Teachers' union is corrupt. That's interesting.
It wasn't just right-wing protesters from outside the district. There were groups on the left as well. The loudest were the revolutionary communists. At one point, a member of the revolutionary communists disrupted the public comment of a man holding a giant American flag, and it quickly transpired into an unsafe environment for students and for queer people. And just by coincidence, Hong, who you just heard from, was in the middle of that melee. She had a pride flag in her hair, and she said when the protest erupted around her, she kind of froze.
Do we like move? Because the people on the side next to us are like people who are looking at us like we're a sickness, you know, who are like clearly don't even care for our own humanity. Like I don't feel safer there than I do next to a fight. It's not safe anywhere in this room, to be honest.
Police ended up escorting the revolutionary communists out of the room. And then the three board members who didn't support the policy actually left the room during the protest. They said in a statement later that they feared for their safety, and they actually didn't return for the vote. So the policy passed with them not in the room.
What exactly did they decide to do at the Orange Unified School District?
So this new policy triggers a parental notification system almost as soon as schools, quote, become aware that a kid is identifying with a name, pronoun, or gender other than the one on their birth certificate, or if they use a different bathroom. So teachers, counselors, administrators are required to notify the principal. From there, the principal is directed to notify the student's parents. Orange Unified actually revised its policy after public outcry twice, and after a court put a hold on a similar policy passed in Chino Valley Unified last week. Now the policy says school officials don't have to notify parents if the student is 12 or older and they can prove that doing so would endanger the child. Opponents of this policy call it forced outing. They say it can put a child at risk of physical or emotional harm when they're essentially outed before they're ready.
With the ruling last week, Robin, is this going to hold up, do you think, in court?
It remains to be seen. So last week, a judge in San Bernardino did rule in favor of Attorney General Rob Bonta, effectively putting a hold on a similar policy to this one from taking effect in Chino Valley while the issue moves through the courts. I asked UCLA education professor John Rogers for his take about all of this, and he told me it's not black and white whether a parent's rights to have information about their child or a child's rights to privacy and to not being discriminated against will ultimately win out in court. But we will see it hashed out in court.
Why are there all of these policies right now, Robin, about notifying parents when kids are questioning their gender?
So this is part of a coordinated effort by Republicans to graft these fights from these kind of national culture wars onto local school boards. And here's what I mean by that. All of these parental notification policies that are moving through school boards in California pull language from a nearly identical state bill that failed earlier this year. The Republican assembly member that introduced that failed bill actually came to the meeting in Orange on Thursday. UCLA education professor John Rogers describes the politics like this.
And certainly the pandemic created frustration and anxiety that parents were feeling, and then that coalesced in attacks on public schools in more conservative or politically contested parts of the state. But it also is the case that at this moment, those anxieties and concerns have been picked up on by party activists who are seeking to gain political advantage in a state in which Republicans have no access to the levers of power.
The battle cry of these Republicans is parental rights. Several parents at the meeting called out what they see as regular intrusion from Sacramento. But we're also dealing with something else here, and that is deep-seated transphobia. Some parents at the meeting told me they believe the schools are pushing kids to identify as transgender. Here's a mother named Anne who didn't want to use her last name because she's afraid of being targeted.
Anytime a child might be having mental health issues, depressed, struggling, I do wonder if sometimes it's being labeled as, oh, we know what this is. You're transgender, and so you need to start all the things.
Jolynn Lang, a parent who came out to oppose the policy, pushed back on that idea, which was held by several people who spoke at the meeting.
The school isn't transitioning people's children. The school is providing a safe space for the children to decide on their own terms when they come out to the world.
And Steve, it was chilling to be surrounded by so much fear and anger and misinformation about schools and about the LGBTQ community.
It sounds like it was really harrowing. It sounds like it's sort of replicated from other school board meetings across the country. Certainly a political and cultural war going on. KCRW's Robin Estrin reporting for us today. Robin, thank you so much for that. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Coming up, Kristen Hirsch, the singer-songwriter, sees color in her music. How her new record is a rainbow of musings and memoir. That's yours on the other side of this. Now more of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
With your breath.
Kristen Hirsch's voice is unmistakable. From her first band, Throwing Muses, to 50-Foot Wave, she's been a front woman for decades, an indie darling paving her own path, one that's included L.A. in her musings as well, having lived here and living in Southern California. Now she's out with a new solo album, her first in 5 years, called Clear Pond Road. And she's here to talk with us about it, and we're going to hear some of it as well. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
This album's been described as a memoir. Is that how you look at it?
They're all memoirs, I guess. They're all true.
Are they?
Sadly, many people think I'm a poet. I'm not. I don't make anything up. It all really happened, and I wrote it down. It's so sad.
You're doing a little Taylor Swift? Is that what you're doing? Talking about the past?
Just ripping out pages in my diary, making little paper airplanes and flying them toward y'all.
Talk a little bit about, I mean, there are field recordings, right, that are incorporated on some of these tracks.
Yeah, I find it enchanting to sort of move beyond the instruments. As obsessed as I am with the instruments I play, the more you move around them with the mics in the studio, the more you realize it's the breathing room that you need most. And I learned that at Kingsway Studios in the French Quarter in New Orleans. You put a mic at the top of the stairs and you hear the whole world, which is in your band, hopefully, if your band doesn't suck. And then once you use up that room mic and its atmosphere, you start wanting to expand its vocabulary, and that is, of course, found in the world. So while I'm on tour, I'm making field recordings that then end up on my actual recordings.
Just with a microphone, just going out there into the world.
Well, just with a telephone going out in the world. They're not good recordings, but they're cool.
But I mean, there's a reason why you're doing it, right? You really want to incorporate what is going on as
really
a part of your music.
If you're not in the band, then you need to stand in the middle of it in order to understand that planet, I guess. And the best way for me to translate music into a language everyone speaks, not just musicians, is to travel around the planet and say, look, it sounds like this. It sounds like birds in Australia and wind chimes in New Orleans. Now do you get it?
Is there a song, Kristen, that you think, I don't know, best fits this idea of memoir, of what you're talking about, of being in the world?
I guess it would be the last track, which is a sad song, and I'm sorry, I don't want to make you sad, but that has both Australian birds and wind chimes in New Orleans in it, and even some barking dogs through everything. But I love that moment. It actually, I won't fake anything. That everything in the song is reflected in the real world. So I wouldn't manipulate that way. In other words, I wouldn't want to hear that, and so I wouldn't make you listen to it. And this one, I have ended up biking around New Orleans, checking my mixes, and ended up right on the street corner where those dogs and the wind chimes were, as the dogs and the wind chimes are playing in the mix.
Wow.
So I stand by that choice.
So let's listen to a little bit of this Tunnels right now.
Medicine's not a medicine show. Right before you go off the rails, you go, you are like me. You can't see tunnels.
You know, your beginnings, Kristen, are very rock and roll, but they also, along with the recordings, they seem a little more unplugged right now. How did that shift happen, you know, toward more acoustic and more instruments that you mentioned? You know, you like to play a lot of things. How did that shift happen?
Well, I was on Warner Brothers for many years, and I felt very strongly that it was a damaging energetic, at least for me. I was not tasked with playing mainstream music, and I didn't feel like what I did was for everyone, and so I removed myself on big purpose, and it wasn't easy. I remember Prince holding the door for me and Warner Brothers one day after we were both leaving meetings, and he said, "We'll win." And I thought, "You'll win."
But he really said that to you while he's holding the door open, Prince?
Yeah, we were both so sad. It's really hard to navigate that when you're coming from a spiritual place. It sounds so goofy and groovy, but I mean it. This is my truth. I do not play mainstream music because I'm not supposed to. So this medicine that I make that is so good for some people and would make other people sick, and I stand by that. But what was your question?
How did the shift, right, from, you know, when you unplugged and you started really a little more ethereal, so, right?
In order to get off of Warner Brothers, I traded them my first solo record for my contractual freedom and throwing muses contractual freedom. And that was fine with them. You know, no problems with each other. So that became my acoustic career. And I thought, this is just nuts, this band that no one is even supposed to care about. You take one member out of it, it's just a trio. They're going to care way less. And they didn't. They cared way more. My first solo record outsold all of Throwing Muses records. And I needed that lesson. Not everyone prefers the bright, loud colors of a painting that is the rock band. Some people prefer the pencil sketch that is the original drawing underneath the painting. And that's what an acoustic song is to
and
me.
And you do a lot of writing, right? This is getting back to sort of the memoir part of this. You know, you're also an author. And I think some folks may know your memoir, Rat Girl, the best because of the acclaim that came with it when it was published. You write in that about your experiences with synesthesia, right? And how it's a part of the creation of your work. Can you talk a little bit about what that is?
I didn't realize that chords didn't come with colors for everyone, obviously, for a long time. But my dad, I had a hippie dad, and he taught me the chords that you need to be a hippie dad, you know. Neil Young, Bob Dylan chords. This is not that many, actually. And I said, great, but now I want more than primary colors. I want ochre and aquamarine and magenta. And he looked at me like I was nuts. And then he said, all right, this is your guitar. Go play colors.
You're about to hit the road and do a tour alongside this new record, Clear Pond Road. You're coming home to L.A. and Southern California?
I'm coming home from Australia and New Zealand, and then I got the winter in the studio with Throwing Muses, and then in the spring I'll come back home to y'all and play.
We look forward to hearing you, seeing you when you do come home to Southern California. Kristen Hirsch, her new album Clear Pond Road is out now. Kristen, thanks for coming on and telling your story.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You above me in the alley, Cupid shooting dandelions. Rusty railings, my boat slipping, my only feeling, thinking you were clean. When I could see you with my dirty eyes, killed the drinking dandelion wine. We are a three-legged race. Steeple chase, it's after midnight, but we don't have far to go. Cupid singing dandelion hope. Blowing dandelion. something burn.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It is birthday time for a gathering place staple of Orange County. The Honda Center Arena in Anaheim opened way back in 1993. And since then, it's become home to some of Orange County favorites, including the hometown Anaheim Ducks. It's also hosted two numerous to count live concerts, like this one, No Doubt's infamous Live and Tragic Kingdom concert in 1997.
Wait a minute. Huh. What about
LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano joins us once again to talk about this iconic venue, what it means to him and to the OC. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
No Doubt played at the arena when it was also known as the Arrowhead Pond. Now, that's going way back, right? That's how it was. That's what it was called way back in the day, right? The Arrowhead Pond at Anaheim. They celebrated their anniversary over the weekend with Gwen Stefani and another performance there. So what's with this No Doubt Honda Center connection?
Well, No Doubt is the greatest thing Anaheim ever produced, especially in music, you know, multi-million album selling group. Gwen, and they were all from Anaheim. Gwen Stefani attended Loera High School. It, famously, she would include her grandma's house in the early videos for No Doubt off of Tragic Kingdom. And that was like just two streets away from where my cousins grew up. So they're hometown heroes. And in her case, she's a hometown heroine. So obviously, like, if they were going to have an anniversary party, it had to be Gwen. And Gwen, to her credit, she, my friends went, they loved it, and she gave a whole bunch of shout outs to all these Anaheim icons, like Mama Casa's, which is a great Italian restaurant, the old Broadway that no longer exists. So totally cool. Like, she's definitely as famous as she is now. She has never forgotten her Anaheim roots.
So Gwen, when she was growing up, when you were growing up in Orange County, you didn't have an arena, right? I mean, what was the landscape like growing up and wanting to go to concerts and all that? Did that involve L.A.?
Oh, yeah, of course, because Orange County, I mean, you'd go to smaller venues like, you know, Anaheim had the legendary J.C. Fandango for Latin music. But if you wanted a big, big place, the biggest place would have been the Pacific Amphitheater, which was only capacity 7,000. So for huge concerts, like, you'd have to go up to back, you know, back in the day, it was called the Great Western Forum. You'll remember that. Or, you know, even, I mean, the huge, huge concerts, of course, would have been in Angel Stadium. But the main reason why the city of Anaheim wanted to build something was not just to bring concerts, but frankly, to bring a professional sports franchise to complement then the Angels and the Rams, the first iteration that, you know, the first Los Angeles Rams that were in Anaheim.
I mean, you've got, again, going back to before it was built, you really were connected to LA. You had to go to LA to see big shows. Now this arena holds, what, 18,000 people. What is its place in Orange County?
Oh, my God. Well, you go there for Ducks games, of course. And the Ducks, they do good, they do bad. It all depends. But people like the Ducks. But really, while you're going there, you're going for all the other events. You go to the concerts. There's a lot of Latin music concerts. Like, the last time I was there was a couple of years ago. Pepe Aguilar had his Jaripeo Sin Frontera. So one big rodeo for both Americans and Mexicans. You go there for the concerts, like No Doubt. You go there for professional bull riding. And there's been all sorts of events. I mean, we go so back. I remember when it originally was called the Anaheim Arena. That was supposed to be its original name. And my tío, my uncle, mi tío Ezequiel, he actually helped in the construction of it, pouring concrete. So he had T-shirts that said Anaheim Arena. And it was right after the Ducks came in that they're like, nah, it shouldn't be Anaheim Arena. Let's call it the Arrowhead, you know, the Arrowhead Arena. Then, of course, people just called it the Pond.
Pond, of course. You know, and I'm getting back to the whole idea, because Orange County has sort of always wanted to be the un-LA, right? Like, we don't want any part of L.A. Was this a part of that? Like, we don't have to go to L.A. to see a big show.
Oh, of course. Like, we wanted to create our own identity, of course. But it's not a beloved place the way Dodger Stadium is. But, you know, it's kind of in the same arena, pardon the pun, as the crypto, whatever it's called now, which I'll always know as Staples. Like, it's a place that's there. But it also signifies that, hey, Orange County is not just a backwater burb. It could support a huge arena. We're 3.1 million people. So in the realm of performers that could perform at an 18,000-seat arena, you should come down to Anaheim. You don't just have to go to the Staples Center, or you could do both because you can support both crowds totally.
All right. Looking at the future, you mentioned Angel Stadium and sort of, you know, the Angels in flux, whether they're going to stay in Anaheim. What will happen, do you think, for this big complex that's over there with the Big A and Honda Center right next door?
Well, Honda Center is stable because the owner of the Honda Center is the owner of the Anaheim Ducks, Henry Samueli, who a multi-billionaire who has committed to developing the area around the, I was going to call it the pond, but around the Honda Center. This is a billionaire who cares about Orange County. He is very much involved with the community. He should just buy the Angels. He would have the huge, huge, huge imprint, and people in Orange County generally trust him. So Moreno, of course, said he was going to sell last year at the beginning of this year, said, no, I'm going to keep it. This year has been yet another disappointing season for the Halos. So Artie, like, be a good guy, do something good for once, sell it to Samueli at a good, you know, good price, and go, you know, and Samueli will create something incredible.
LA Times, Gustavo Arellano with us, of course, a regular here at GLA. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, mushrooms and other plant-based psychedelics may be getting a legal thumbs up if Governor Newsom signs a bill passed in Sacramento. What could it mean going forward? That's tomorrow on GLA. Visit us online anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us how you're doing. Share with us a story idea. Complain about the heat. We don't care. kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Zeke Reed, Celine Mendiola, Phil Richards, John Meek, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all help make this show happen. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your attention. Thanks for that ear tonight. Have a great night.